Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story.
Ireland Crimes and Mysteries is presented by Go Loud, Ireland's leading audio publisher and the home of Irish podcasts. Find new episodes on the podcast first on the Go Loud app and on your favourite podcast platform.
On a freezing winter's night in December 2000, a 28-year-old woman stepped out of a chip shop in a small Mayo village and simply vanished. That woman was Sandra Collins. 25 years later, her family still don't know where she is. They don't know what happened in those missing hours, and they certainly don't know where she's buried. What we do know is this. Sandra left her aunt's house at 7:30 that evening, saying she was going for chips. By 11 o'clock that night, she'd bought her food and disappeared into the darkness. All that was ever found of her was a fleece jacket on the pier, a half a pound of sausages still in its pocket, and two pieces of paper with desperate clues scribbled on them. This case shattered a family that was already broken. Her brother James had been killed in an accident just 6 months before Sandra vanished. Their parents never fully recovered from either loss. But what makes Sandra's story even more haunting is this. Somewhere in County Mayo, people know what happened. The Gardaí believe it. The family believes it. And yet, after 2.5 decades, Sandra Collins is still missing. Sandra Collins was born in 1971, the eldest of 6 children in a blended family from Crossmolina, County Mayo. Her birth father, Francie, died when she was just 7 years old in 1978. Her mother, Eleanor, remarried a man named Joe Collins, and together they had 3 more children, Patrick, David, and Mary. Sandra's full siblings from her mother's first marriage were James and Bridie. By all accounts, Sandra was the type of person who lived to help others. She was kind, gentle, a little shy. The sort of young woman who'd check on elderly neighbours, who'd ask if they needed anything from the shop before she went herself. People in Killala remembered her as someone who always had time for a chat, who never complained, who just got on with things. And that caring nature led her to become a full-time carer for her aunt, Anne O'Grady. In 1988, when Sandra was just 17 years old, she moved from the family home in Crossmolina to Killala, a small seaside village about 15 kilometres away, to live with her aunt, Anne. Anne suffered from severe arthritis and needed help with daily tasks. What likely started as a temporary arrangement, just helping out for a few weeks, maybe even a few months, became Sandra's life for the next 12 years. From the age of 17 to 28, Sandra dedicated herself to caring for her aunt. She gave up her teenage years, her 20s, the time when most young women were out exploring the world, going on dates, building careers, and living independently. Instead, Sandra lived at Courthouse Street in Killala with her days revolving around her aunt's needs, getting her aunt dressed in the morning, helping her move around the house, managing the pain of arthritis, which can be debilitating on bad days, doing the shopping, the cooking, the cleaning, making sure Anne took her medication, keeping her company during the long, dark evenings. 12 years Sandra looked after her aunt with dedication and love, never complaining, never asking for recognition. Sandra's life wasn't glamorous. She didn't have a car, she didn't have a mobile phone. She'd been planning to buy one with her social welfare Christmas bonus that December. Her social life was limited. Her income was minimal. Just what she received as a carer, barely enough to get by. On Sundays, she and Anne would make the trip to visit the family home in Crossmolina. Sandra would sit in the sitting room with her mother Eleanor, chatting about everyday things, small talk, family news, nothing dramatic. Just that Sunday before she disappeared, December 3rd, 2000, Sandra had been at the family home, showing her mother a picture of the mobile phone she was going to buy. It was only a small thing, but it mattered to her. A bit of independence, a way to stay connected. A sign, perhaps, that she was thinking about the future, about staying in touch with people, about having her own life beyond caring for Anne. But as I said, the year 2000 had been an absolutely brutal year for the Collins family. 6 months before Sandra vanished, in June 2000, their brother James was killed in a workplace accident at a factory, and he was just 26 years old. The family were devastated. James was young, full of life, and then suddenly he was gone. The Collins family was still deep in grief, still trying to process the shock and the pain of losing him, still trying to figure out how to move forward, how to keep going when the world felt like it had just stopped. Eleanor, their mother, was struggling. Losing a child is a pain that never fully heals, and she was still raw from James's death when December came around. The family that had buried James in June were now facing another unthinkable tragedy. Except this time, there was no body to bury, no funeral, no grave to visit. Just the emptiness and the questions and the horrifying possibility that they might never know what happened. 10 days before her 29th birthday, Sandra walked out into a winter's night and never came home. She never got to buy that mobile phone. She never got to celebrate another Christmas with her family. She never got to see her nieces and nephews grow up. Her brother Patrick would later say that Sandra's disappearance, coming so soon after James's death, was the closest thing to hell their family had ever experienced. Because at least with James, they could bury him. They could visit his grave. They could say goodbye. With Sandra, there was nothing. No body, no grave, no closure. Just an empty space where she should have been. And 25 years of wondering where she is. Monday, the 4th of December 2000, was a miserable winter's night in Killala. Wet, windy, the kind of night where you'd want to stay indoors by the fire. But for Sandra Collins, the 4th of December had already been one of the most stressful days of her life. That morning, Sandra had rung her GP to get the results of a second pregnancy test. The first test, done on Friday, the 1st of December, had come back positive. But Sandra had asked for another test to be certain. When she called on Monday morning, the doctor confirmed what she already feared. She was pregnant, about 9 or 10 weeks along. Sandra was unmarried, living with her elderly aunt, with no steady income beyond her carer's allowance. In the Ireland of 2000, this was still a source of deep shame for any woman. Abortion was illegal in the Republic. Women in Sandra's situation had to travel to England, a journey that required money, planning, and in a lot of cases, secrecy. Sandra had made her decision quickly. She told her GP she was adamant she couldn't have this baby. She was going to travel to England for a termination. The doctor, trying to be kind, told her not to panic. She had time. She was only 9 or 10 weeks along. She didn't need to rush into a decision she might regret. But Sandra's mind was made up. She knew what she had to do. Throughout that Monday, multiple witnesses saw Sandra at a phone box outside McGregor's shop in Killala. She was there for hours, making call after call, looking upset and a little agitated. People who saw her said she looked distressed. One witness described her as appearing anxious, pacing near the phone box between calls. Gardaí obtained phone records and discovered she'd been ringing abortion clinics in England, trying to arrange an appointment. Phone records showed she'd contacted the British Pregnancy Advisory Service in Birmingham. She was researching the process, finding out the costs and making plans. The cost would have been £295 sterling, £50 for an assessment, £245 for the termination itself. For Sandra, living on a carer's allowance, this was a significant sum. Where would she get that kind of money? But Sandra wasn't just calling abortion clinics that day. Phone records would later reveal she was also in contact with someone else, a local man. They spoke multiple times throughout December 4th. But here is what makes the timeline of that day so crucial and so mysterious. At around 7:30 that evening, Sandra left her aunt's house on Courthouse Street. She told Anne she was going to Baran's shop, a 5-minute walk, to buy some groceries. She stopped at an elderly neighbour's house and asked if he needed anything from the shop. Then she went to Baran's, where she bought fire lighters, bread, milk and a half a pound of sausages. That was around 7:45 p.m. And then Sandra vanished for nearly 4 hours. Nobody knows where she was, nobody saw her. On a wet, windy December night in a small village where everyone knows everyone, Sandra Collins disappeared completely between roughly 7:45 p.m. and 11:15 p.m. Here's what makes this so significant. When Sandra Collins finally reappeared at the Country Kitchen Chipper on George Street at around 11:05 to 11:15 p.m, witnesses said something strange. Despite the fact it was absolutely lashing rain outside, despite the wind and the cold, Sandra was bone dry. No umbrella, no rain on her clothes, no wet hair. Just wearing her light fleece jacket and completely dry. The woman working in the chipper that night, whose testimony would later be crucial, remembered Sandra well. She said it was unusual because Sandra normally ate in at the chipper. It was warm, it was dry. Why not stay? But that night she ordered a large bag of chips, enough for two people really, and then took them to go. The chipper worker said Sandra didn't seem upset or distressed at this point. She wasn't crying. She wasn't agitated like she'd been earlier at the phone box. She just ordered her chips, paid and left. Sandra tucked the chips under her coat and walked out into the night. That was 11:15 p.m. the 4th of December 2000. It was the last time anyone ever saw Sandra Collins alive. So where had she been for those missing hours? The fact that she was dry suggests she'd been indoors somewhere. The fact she bought chips for two suggests she might have been meeting someone. But who? And where? Her family believed Sandra had been with someone during those missing hours. Someone she trusted. Someone who lived close enough to Killala that she could get there and back without getting soaked. Someone who knew her well enough that she felt comfortable staying for hours. The two pieces of paper found later in her fleece pocket would suggest who that someone might have been. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Because first, Sandra had to disappear completely. After leaving the chipper at 11:15 p.m, Sandra Collins walked into the darkness and, as I said, was never seen again. Her aunt Anne waited up for her late into the night. When Sandra didn't come home, Anne wasn't immediately alarmed. Sandra was an adult after all. Maybe she'd stayed with a friend. Maybe she'd gone to Cross Malina to see family. But by the next day, when Sandra still hadn't returned, when she hadn't checked in, when there was no word at all, the family knew something was terribly wrong. Sandra wouldn't just disappear. She wouldn't leave her aunt alone without a word. She was too responsible, too caring. On the 9th of December 2000, 4 days after Sandra vanished, a discovery was made on the pier in Killala that would change everything. There, folded neatly on the pier, was Sandra's fleece jacket. The jacket wasn't thrown or discarded, it was folded carefully, and it felt like it was placed there deliberately. Inside one of the pockets was the half pound of sausages she'd bought at Baran's shop, still there, unopened. And in another pocket were two pieces of paper, wet from the sea spray. On one piece of paper was the mobile phone number of a local man. On the other piece of paper were numbers for two abortion clinics in Britain. When Gardaí examined the fleece, they believed it had been placed there deliberately. It was folded neatly, as I said, not thrown around or not just discarded. The sleeves were aligned, the collar tucked under. The location, the condition, everything suggested someone wanted it to look like Sandra had jumped into the sea, that she'd taken her own life because of her pregnancy. But Sandra's family refused to believe that. They knew her. She wasn't suicidal. She'd made a plan for the pregnancy. She had an appointment booked for the 20th of December. She was stressed, yes, but she was coping. She had a way forward. And besides, if Sandra had jumped from that pier, where was her body? The sea usually gives up its dead eventually. Searches of the water and coastline found nothing. Sandra's family believed, and Gardaí would eventually come to agree, that someone had killed Sandra Collins and staged the scene to make it look like suicide. The question was, who? The discovery of Sandra's fleece on the 9th of December 2000 changed everything. What had been a missing persons case was now being treated as something far more sinister. Gardaí launched a massive investigation. They searched the waters around Killala Pier with divers and sonar equipment. They scoured the coastline for weeks. The Coast Guard was brought in. Helicopters swept the area. Search teams combed through fields and bogs around the village. Teams of Gardaí and volunteers covered every inch of terrain around Killala and the surrounding areas. They drained ponds. They searched abandoned buildings. They followed up on every possible lead, every potential sighting, every rumour in the community. Nothing. No body, no clothing, no trace of Sandra was found. The investigation team started piecing together Sandra's movements on that final day. They spoke to everyone who'd seen her. The shopkeeper at Bernan's, the woman at the country kitchen chipper, people who'd spotted her at the phone box throughout the afternoon. And that's when a pattern started to emerge. Multiple witnesses reported seeing Sandra at a phone box outside McGregor's shop throughout the 4th of December. She was making call after call, looking distressed and agitated. Gardaí obtained phone records and discovered she'd been ringing abortion clinics in England, eventually booking an appointment for the 20th of December. But as I said, she'd also been making calls to and receiving calls from a local man, a local married man from the area. Phone records show that Sandra had called this man's mobile phone multiple times that day, and crucially, he had made calls back to the phone box where Sandra was standing. They were in contact throughout the day she disappeared. This was significant because this man, according to what would emerge later, had been having a relationship with Sandra in the weeks before she vanished. He was married with a young daughter at the time. He lived locally, close enough to Killala that Sandra would have walked to his place and stayed maybe for those missing hours without anyone noticing. And then there were those two pieces of paper in Sandra's fleece pocket. One that had that man's mobile number on, and the other that had the abortion clinics in Britain. But having a relationship with a missing woman isn't the same as murdering her. And despite their suspicions, Gardaí didn't have enough evidence to charge anyone. Not yet. The case went cold for years. Sandra's family kept searching, kept appealing, kept the case in the public eye. Every December, they marked the anniversary of her disappearance. In 2006, Sandra's stepfather Joe started a tradition, decorating their house in Cross Malina with Christmas lights on the 4th of December, the anniversary of her disappearance, and raising money for charity. It was his way of keeping Sandra's memory alive and not letting the world forget her. The family's pain was unimaginable. Sandra's mother, Eleanor, died in 2004, just 4 years after Sandra vanished. She was only 53 years old. The stress and anguish of losing her daughter, never knowing what happened to her, never being able to bury her, had taken its toll. Eleanor died still believing, hoping, that Sandra might somehow come home. Sandra's stepfather Joe died in 2016 at the age of 70. He never got to see justice for Sandra. He never got to bury her alongside her brother James. In 2010, a decade after Sandra disappeared, Gardaí formally upgraded the case from a missing person investigation to a murder investigation. They believed Sandra was dead. They believed she'd been killed. And they believed someone in the community knew what happened. Then in December 2012, 12 years after Sandra vanished, there was a breakthrough. Gardaí arrested a man in connection with Sandra's murder. A local man. He had been working in England at the time. And when he returned to Ireland for Christmas in 2012, Gardaí were waiting for him. He was arrested in late December and brought to Ballina Garda Station. At 7:40 p.m. that evening, he was formally charged with the murder of Sandra Collins on or about the 4th of December 2000 at a place unknown within the state. When asked to respond to the charge, he just said these words, "Nothing to answer." The Collins family were in court for that first appearance. So was the accused man's family. After 12 years of waiting, of wondering, of hoping for answers, they were finally going to get their day in court. Or so they thought. The trial of the man accused of murdering Sandra Collins began in May 2014 at the Central Criminal Court, sitting in Castlebar, County Mayo. It lasted 17 days. And for the Collins family, those 17 days represented 14 years of waiting, of hoping, of praying for answers. Mr. Justice Patrick McCarthy presided over the trial. The prosecution was led by Dennis Vaughan Buckley, SC. The defence was led by Michael O'Higgins, SC. The prosecution's case was straightforward. They alleged that the accused had the motive and the opportunity to murder Sandra Collins. The motive? Sandra was pregnant. And according to what emerged at trial, the father of that child was the accused, the married man she'd been having a relationship with in the weeks before she disappeared. The prosecution argued that when Sandra found out she was pregnant on the 4th of December 2000, she contacted the accused. She wanted money for the termination, reportedly asking for £1,000. This detail emerged during the trial testimony, a sum far exceeding the actual cost of the procedure, but perhaps reflecting Sandra's desperation and her belief that the father of the child should bear the financial burden. But the accused, with a wife and baby daughter at home, didn't want their relationship exposed. He didn't want Sandra having his child. He didn't want to pay. And according to the prosecution, he decided the only way out was to kill her. The opportunity? The prosecution pointed to Sandra's movements that night. During those missing hours between 7:45 p.m. and 11:15 p.m., Sandra had been somewhere indoors. She was bone dry when she appeared at the chipper, despite the lashing rain. The prosecution suggested she'd been with the accused during this time. This established their contact that evening. And after she left the chipper at 11:15 p.m, the prosecution argued she'd met with the accused again, and that's when he killed her. But here's the problem with this case. There's no body, no murder weapon, no crime scene, no forensic evidence, no witnesses to the actual killing. What the prosecution had was circumstantial evidence, and a lot of it. They had phone records showing Sandra and the accused were in contact throughout the 4th of December, multiple calls between Sandra at the phone box and the accused mobile. They had two pieces of paper in Sandra's fleece pocket, one with the accused's number, one with the abortion clinic's numbers. They had testimony from Sandra's GP that she was pregnant, and it told him she intended to travel to England for a termination. The doctor testified that Sandra had first come to see him on Friday, the 1st of December 2000. The pregnancy test came back positive, but Sandra, wanting to be absolutely certain, asked for a second test. On Monday, the 4th of December, the day she disappeared, Sandra rang the surgery for the results. The second test was also positive. She was pregnant, approximately 9 to 10 weeks along. The GP testified that Sandra told him that she was adamant. She had made her decision. She was going to England for a termination. And as I said, he told her not to panic, that she had time, that she didn't have to rush a decision she might regret. But Sandra was firm. Her mind was made up. They had testimony from witnesses who saw Sandra at the phone box looking stressed and agitated. The prosecution also called the Associate Director of Nursing at the British Pregnancy Advisory Service. He gave evidence about phone calls made from the phone box in Killala to their Birmingham office. He explained the pricing structure for terminations in December 2000. He explained that the abortion clinics most commonly used by women travelling from Ireland were in Liverpool or London due to transportation logistics. Women would typically fly or take the ferry, have the procedure and return home, all while keeping it secret from their families and their communities. This testimony painted a picture of Sandra's desperation. She was researching, planning, calculating costs, all while trying to figure out how to raise nearly £300. And they had something else, something that would prove to be both compelling and problematic. the fleece itself became a major focus of the testimony. Sandra's sister, Bridie, identified it in court as belonging to Sandra. She testified that it was found on the 9th of December, 4 days after Sandra disappeared. A retired detective sergeant gave evidence about the discovery and the condition of the fleece. The defence questioned why it wasn't found until the 9th of December, even though there was evidence of a civilian sighting of it on the 6th of December. He said he was unaware of earlier sightings. The defence also questioned why pieces of paper with phone numbers in the pockets weren't discovered for some days after the garment had been recovered. The retired sergeant explained that the fleece was soaking wet when found, was covered in mud, and was an absolute mess. It needed to be dried out before it could be properly searched. During his testimony, he also revealed something troubling. He had taken a packet of sausages found in the fleece to Ballinagh Garda Station for examination and to be photographed, but they disappeared from his desk. Possibly taken by a cleaner, he suggested. This raised questions about evidence handling in the early stages of the investigation. In June 2001, 7 months after Sandra disappeared, the accused had been interviewed by a special team of Garda investigators. During that interview, he admitted to having a relationship with Sandra in the weeks before she vanished. He admitted they'd had sex twice. This was significant because, until that point, he'd never mentioned knowing Sandra beyond casual acquaintance. But there was more. A retired Garda detective gave evidence about a conversation he'd had with the accused in 2001. According to this detective, the accused had asked him a strange question. Would the Collins family be satisfied with a bone? He'd also asked whether a man could be convicted if no body was found. These were damning questions. Why would an innocent man ask such things? Then there was testimony from another man who told the court that in March 2011, over a decade after Sandra disappeared, the accused had told him what happened that night. According to his testimony, the accused said he'd met Sandra at Killala Pier on the night of the 4th of December 2000. They'd argued. And during the argument, Sandra had accidentally fallen into the water. The accused, according to this man, said he didn't jump in to save her. Why? Because he couldn't swim. This testimony was explosive. If true, it meant the accused had been present when Sandra died. It meant he'd watched her fall or perhaps pushed her into the dark, cold water of Killala Harbour. It meant he'd stood there on that pier and let her drown. And then he stayed silent about it for over a decade, allowing her family to suffer, allowing searches to continue, allowing hope to linger when there was none. If this testimony was true, it meant the accused had been living with this knowledge for 11 years before he supposedly confessed to this man in a casual conversation. But was it true? The defence would argue it wasn't. There was also evidence about comments allegedly made by the accused in a pub in Killala on the 27th of December 2010, exactly 10 years after Sandra disappeared. According to a witness, the accused had wondered aloud what happened to Sandra Collins. He'd allegedly said, "They can do nothing if they haven't got a body." Again, if true, these were the words of someone who knew exactly what had happened to Sandra. Someone who believed he was safe because her body hadn't been found. The defence, however, painted a very different picture. Michael O'Higgins QC argued that the entire case against his client was built on suspicion, not evidence. Yes, his client had a relationship with Sandra. Yes, there was contact on the 4th of December, but that didn't make him a murderer. The defence pointed out that there was no physical evidence linking the accused to Sandra's disappearance, no forensic evidence, no witness who saw them together that night, no proof that Sandra had even been in his car or his home, no DNA, no fingerprints, nothing concrete tying him to the crime. The fleece found on the pier? The defence argued it could have been placed there by anyone, including Sandra herself. Yes, it was folded neatly. But who's to say Sandra didn't fold it? Maybe she'd placed it there deliberately before taking her own life. The prosecution wanted the jury to see staging. but the defence argued it could just as easily be evidence of suicide. The phone records? They prove contact, yes, but many people were in contact with Sandra that day. She'd been making calls all afternoon. The fact that she'd spoke to the accused didn't prove he'd killed her. It just proved they knew each other, which was never in dispute. The testimony from the man about the peer confession, the defence suggested this was unreliable. Why had he waited years to come forward with this information? Why should the jury believe him now? The questions about bones and bodies, the defence argued these were taken out of context, twisted to sound sinister when they were innocent curiosity. As for the accused admission of a sexual relationship with Sandra, yes, he admitted it, but he'd also consistently denied killing her. From his arrest in 2012 to his response when charged, nothing to answer, he maintained his innocence. The prosecution had built a case on circumstances, on phone calls and conversations and questions asked years ago. But they couldn't prove murder. They couldn't even prove Sandra was dead, technically speaking, because they'd never found her body. And that, ultimately, was the problem. After 17 days of testimony, after hearing from dozens of witnesses, after examining phone records and evidence and timelines, Mr. Justice Patrick McCarthy made a decision. On the 5th of June 2014, he directed the jury to acquit the accused. For legal reasons, ladies and gentlemen, I am directing you to acquit the accused, the judge said. There was insufficient evidence to convict. The man who had been charged with Sandra Collins' murder walked free. He broke down in the courtroom, hugging members of his legal team. For him, this was vindication. Justice. But for the Collins family sobbing in the body of the court, this was devastation. Sandra's brother Patrick spoke to the media outside the courthouse. The Gardaí reassured us in that court today that their door is open in Ballina always and that Sandra's case is never closed, he said. It's an ongoing investigation and will stay an ongoing investigation until we get her back and until we get closure. The case wasn't about seeing anyone brought to justice anymore, Patrick said. It was about finding Sandra, bringing her home and giving her a proper burial. At this stage, we just want a body, he told reporters. It's not about justice for us now. We have been down that road already. 25 years have passed since Sandra Collins walked out of that chipper in Killala and disappeared into the December night. 25 years of searching. 25 years of hoping, 25 years of grief that can never fully heal because there's no body to bury, no grave to visit, no final goodbye. The impact on the Collins family has been immeasurable. As I said, Sandra's mother Eleanor died in 2004, just 4 years after Sandra vanished, and she was only 53 years old. The cancer that killed her was likely hastened by the stress and anguish of losing her daughter. She never saw Sandra's case upgraded to murder. She never saw anyone arrested or charged. She died still holding onto a small bit of hope, a romanticised notion, as her son Patrick described it, that maybe Sandra had run away, that maybe she'd come back someday. Patrick remembered his mother's sleepless nights. She would sit in the kitchen in the depths of winter and during the long days of summer staring out the window, wondering where Sandra was. The not knowing consumed her. Trevor Deely, another young Irish person, had gone missing just days after Sandra. Eleanor, God love her, had convinced herself that maybe Sandra and Trevor had run off together. Maybe they'd come back. It was a fantasy, a coping mechanism, but it gave her something to hold on to in the darkest of moments. Sandra's stepfather, Joe, as I said, died in 2016 at age 70. And he'd started that tradition that continues to this day of decorating the family house in Crossmolina with Christmas lights. Every 4th of December, the anniversary of Sandra's disappearance. It started small. Joe didn't know what else to do with his grief. So he put up some lights, then more lights, then decorations. Year after year, the display grew bigger, brighter, more elaborate. It became a beacon in Crossmolina, impossible to miss. Neighbours and friends began to join in, helping with the decorations, standing with the family in solidarity. And every year, the family uses the occasion to raise money for charity. They collect donations as people come to see the lights. Over the years, they've raised thousands of euros for various causes: Down Syndrome Ireland, autism charities, local community groups. It's become Sandra's legacy. Even in her absence, she's still helping people. I wish that Sandra could know that even in her death, she's helped so many people, Patrick said in a recent interview. Because when she was alive, all she ever did was help people. But Eleanor and Joe died never knowing what happened to their daughter, never getting to bury her alongside her brother James. For Sandra's surviving siblings, the pain is ongoing. It's not something that fades with time. It's a wound that can't heal. Patrick Collins has become the public voice for the family. Every year, on every anniversary, he makes appeals for information. He speaks to the media. He appears on podcasts and documentaries. He's done everything possible to keep Sandra's case in the public eye. In recent years, the family has launched billboard campaigns in Mayo. Large posters with Sandra's face and details about the case have been placed at bus stops in Ballina and Castlebar, places where people wait, where they have time to look, to read, to think. The hope is that someone standing at that bus stop might see Sandra's face and remember something, might finally decide to come forward. They've set up a GoFundMe page to fund searches and investigations. Since it was established in 2020, they've raised over 10,000 euro. That money has gone towards the billboard campaign, towards offering a reward for information leading to the discovery of Sandra's remains, and towards potentially hiring experts to help locate her. If you'd like to support the family's efforts to bring Sandra home, you will find the link to the GoFundMe page in the description below. The family have even considered hiring a US criminal profiler, someone with expertise in cold case and missing persons, to help Gardaí locate Sandra's remains. They're willing to try anything, spend whatever they can raise, do whatever it takes to bring her home. In 2022, Patrick received an anonymous phone call at Christmas, someone claiming to have information about where Sandra might be buried. The family met with Gardaí and the tip was treated as credible. But so far, it hasn't led to Sandra's recovery. The family's message has been consistent. This isn't about justice anymore. It's not about seeing anyone punished. It's about finding Sandra and bringing her home. This is not about seeing anyone brought to justice. We are not out to get anyone, Patrick has said. All we want to do is find Sandra and bury her with her mother and her father and our brother James. He's made it clear that they would meet with anyone who has information. They would even thank the person who tells them where Sandra is, regardless of their involvement, if it means getting her back. If we just found her, I can't even begin to imagine how we would feel, Patrick said. It would be the greatest gift we could get. Because right now, Sandra's nieces and nephews, children who were born after she disappeared, will never know their Aunt Sandra. The family can't visit her grave, they can't lay flowers, they can't grieve properly. I couldn't help her then, I can't help her now, Patrick said on the 25th anniversary of her disappearance. I can't get her, bring her home, can't go and visit her grave. He described living with constant hope and constant disappointment. Every time the post arrives, his heart races. Maybe today someone will send a letter with information. Maybe today will be the day. He described opening a handwritten letter one morning, his heart pounding, thinking maybe the person responsible has finally had a fit of conscience. But it wasn't about Sandra at all. It's just how you live your life, he said. And it's not just today that's happened. You're just always wondering and hoping that we'll find her. That's the reality for the Collins family. 25 years of every knock on the door, every phone call, every letter bringing a spike of hope. Maybe this is it. Maybe this is news about Sandra, followed by crushing disappointment when it's not. This is something that I can't really describe to people, he said. I think it's the closest thing to hell that there can exist on this planet. When somebody you love is out there and you don't know where they are and where they're buried. The Gardaí have never stopped investigating. The case remains active. Every few years, there's a renewed appeal, a fresh search, a new lead. Detective Inspector John Costello has emphasised that circumstances change over time. Relationships change, loyalties change, he said. And people may not now be constrained by the set of circumstances that existed for them 25 years ago. The investigation team believes that there are people in the community who know what happened to Sandra. People who know where she is. Maybe they were afraid to speak up 25 years ago. Maybe they felt loyal to someone. Maybe they didn't think their information was important. But time changes things. People who were young in 2000 are now middle-aged. Relationships that existed then have ended. Loyalties have shifted. And Gardaí are hoping that someone, anyone, will finally come forward. The unanswered questions in this case are haunting. Where was Sandra during those missing hours between 7:45 p.m. and 11:15 p.m. on the 4th of December 2000? Who was she with? Why was she completely dry despite the pouring rain? Why did she buy enough chips for two people? Who was she planning to share them with? What happened after she left the country kitchen chipper at 11:15 p.m.? Where did she go? How did she die? And most importantly, where is Sandra Collins? Is she buried in a bog, in a forest, in someone's property, under concrete? Searches over the years have covered vast areas, but Mayo is a big county with endless places to hide a body. Someone has carried this secret for 25 years, and the Collins family is begging that person, whoever they are, to finally do the right thing. Please come forward and let us find Sandra, Patrick has said. She doesn't deserve to be left in some ditch or some drain or some bog hole wrapped in God knows what. Let us bury her properly with the dignity she deserves. Sandra Collins was 28 years old when she disappeared. She would now be 53, the same age her mother was when she died. She was a kind woman, a caring woman, someone who looked after her elderly aunt for 12 years. She deserves better than to be forgotten, better than to be left wherever she was hidden. Her family deserves closure. They deserve to finally say goodbye. If you have any information about Sandra Collins' disappearance or the location of her remains, please contact Ballina Garda Station on 096-205-60. The Garda Confidential Line on 1-800-666-111 or any Garda station in the country. Anyone who contacts on Garda Síochána will be treated with confidentiality, compassion and sensitivity. Please help bring Sandra Collins home.
So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast. Again, thanks for your listenership and don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.